Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
You're listening to the FT Money Show, brought to you by Investors Chronicle and FT Money.
Hello and welcome to the FT Money Show. In today's programme, end-of-year tax strategies that the Chancellor won't change his mind on, as well as what the Chancellor did change his mind on when clarifying his new tax rules for non-domiciled investors. Plus, a new way to profit from falling commodities prices in volatile markets, and some good news and bad news for bank account savers. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with the help of my colleague from FT Money, Steve Lodge.
Hello.
And from Investors Chronicle, John McLeod.
Hello.
Hello to you both. So let's start then with the money news. This week, private client broker Hargreaves Lansdown put out a forecast that sales of tax-efficient individual savings accounts, or ISAs, in the next few months would be lower than the sales seen at the same time last year because investors are now wary of falling stock markets. But even if you don't want to buy an equity ISA right now, other advisors are suggesting that there are still some tax-efficient investments worth using. Steve, you're never a man to pay tax and you don't have to. What strategies are being recommended right now?
Clearly, people are cautious about markets, and that is what is driving this caution to take up ISAs if people haven't already, or indeed put money into SIPs, you know, SIPs being the new ISAs and so on. But a number of brokers and financial experts are suggesting actually just using this as a kind of good housekeeping time and actually indulging in things called, slightly oddly, bed and sipping, bed and ISA-ing, in-specie contributions. Think of them more as kind of share exchange mechanisms. So you've got shares and other holdings outside you that are currently taxed in your portfolio. There are a range of ways of getting them inside, whether it's an ISA or a SIP, and therefore benefiting from all those tax perks.
So they call all these strange things because of the old rule called bed and breakfasting, where you could sell an investment holding, leave it overnight, so to speak, in a bed and breakfast,
well,
and buy it back the next day.
About 30 days now on bed and breakfast.
That, of course, that's changed. You're right. Yes. If you sell now, you can't repurchase for 30 days.
And still qualify for the CGT
and realise your gain within your capital gains tax allowance. So because of bed and breakfasting, these things are now called bed and ISA-ing or bed and sipping.
Bed and ISA-ing, exactly. So same principle. You're effectively, I mean, they do work in different ways. I mean, conceptually, it is possible in some instances to actually just physically move the asset into the ISA, not the ISA actually, technically into the SIP. And that makes sense with very illiquid assets where you'd face big spread costs in selling and then buying back. But it's sometimes, I think in some ways it's easier to think about actually just selling a share outside the ISA or the SIP and then buying it back inside. And of course, the big advantage of that is that you're getting all those tax breaks, including all the upfront pension tax reliefs, without really, in net terms, committing any extra cash, which might suit a lot of people, given what's happening in markets currently and uncertainty and worries about recession and so on.
So when do you have to do this in order to make it tax efficient?
Well, obviously there is a certain end of tax year impetus to this. It could be a way of taking up an ISA before the end of tax year if you haven't already. Don't forget as well there's upfront income tax relief on pensions. Now, while the contribution rules have been flexed up, so you can now contribute 100% of your earnings up to 200 and some thousand pounds, so clearly most people aren't going to run up against those limits. And so in a sense, there's less of a tax year end impetus to that, except, of course, if you're changing tax bands. But it's also got the attraction that, take an example, you've got £1,000 of shares, you effectively, one way or another, bed and sipping or in-specie contribution, put them into a SIP. That £1,000 is then grossed up within the pension by basic rate tax relief, which adds, slightly oddly, £282 there, but then you can claim a further £231 back through your tax return as a higher rate taxpayer. So it's also a kind of way of unlocking cash from pensions as well, which might suit some people. Obviously, what you've done is you've shunted a rather bigger holding into a pension, and that is going to be tied up till retirement in broad terms. But at the same time, you've got the ability to reduce your tax bill. And indeed, in some cases, get to actually take some cash out.
So it's all about making use of all of the reliefs and all of the allowances that are actually there. Just finally, though, for those investors who are wary about plunging into stock market investments right now, and that's what Hargreaves Lansdown was saying, could depress the sales of ISAs this year. What about holding cash in an ISA? What are the rules there?
Well, exactly. It's often not appreciated that a stocks and shares ISA, or indeed a SIP or some other pension product, doesn't mean putting money in there, whether it's through a bed and SIP, bed and ISA, or just putting money in there, doesn't mean you're automatically getting market exposure. It might mean you do need to check the terms and conditions of the particular product you're going into. But something called a self-select ISA should allow you to select cash. So you put your cash in there, whether it's from the sale of an existing holding that you are going to buy back, or indeed just cash contribution, and hold that cash there. Now, within an ISA, you're not probably going to get the best cash returns. These, remember, are different from true cash ISAs, where you're getting tax-free interest, which are and tax-free interest rates that are often better than normal savings rates. Brokers, this is one of the way that brokers make money. They want you to be in stocks and shares, and indeed the revenue does. So you'll earn some interest, but it probably won't be very much. You will also pay a 20% tax charge within that as well, that will be taken off automatically. But within a SIP, you can, of course, invest in cash and earn tax-free returns through a money market fund. So you'll get sort of more money market-related returns of, you know, whatever it is currently, sort of 5% plus, I would imagine, is perfectly possible. But indeed, of course, remember that the whole point about a pension is that this is long-term savings and you're likely to get better long-term returns being exposed to the equity market. So you can do that. You can have those short-term bolt holes. Of course, you can sell assets as well within an ISA and a pension. And so long as you've got that kind of self-select kind of arrangement, you can hold cash in the short term, wait till market conditions look a little bit more amenable. And finally, you can put money into both ISAs and SIPs. And again, depending on the self-select, the flexibility of the arrangement, drip feed the money in. Perhaps automatically some companies have an auto phasing facility where they literally split the money up and invest it on the same day every month for the next 6 months. Others just say, fine, you choose whatever. And so you might want to wait till the next market fall, put half your money in, and then wait for a further fall and put another half of your money in. Of course, then the risk is that you're still reliant on your own timing and you might get it completely wrong. But these are some of the ways of just spreading the risk.
So you can use your ISA, you can use your SIP tactically. Steve, thanks very much indeed. And if you'd like to know more about bed and sipping, or if like me you thought it was something to do with cocoa or Horlicks, you can actually get the full lowdown on exactly what it means, how to take advantage of it, by reading Steve's article in FT Money in the Weekend FT on the 16th and 17th of February, also online at ft.com/money. And you can send in your questions for us to answer by emailing us at ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. Still to come in the programme, exchange-traded commodities that can profit from falling prices, and some good news and bad news on high-interest savings accounts. But first, tax changes for non-domiciled investors and holders of offshore trusts. This week, the Chancellor gave a clarification on controversial proposals to charge non-doms an annual tax of £30,000. In what sounded like a climb down, investors with income and gains made abroad now won't have to disclose it, and gains will not be taxed retrospectively, as had been suggested. So if you've got money offshore, how do these clarified tax rules affect you? Well, to find out, Ellen Kelleher of FT Money telephoned Mike Warburton of Grant Thornton.
So, Mike, this week the Treasury seemed to soften its stance on the proposed changes to the taxation of non-doms living in this country. How are you, your clients reacting to that?
It is stated to be clarification. It's helpful. It's nice to have clarification. I actually don't think it is clarification. I think it is the government accepting that some aspects of their proposals were too extreme and they've pulled back a bit. The aspect that they've changed their view on is what we termed the disclosure. As you know, people who are currently resident in the UK but not domiciled, not only do they not have to pay tax on their unremitted offshore income and capital gains, that's the gains they make and income they make that they keep outside the country, they've had no need to disclose the sources of any such income or gains. I think when these proposals were announced, the Treasury thought this was a great opportunity to obtain more information about such people's offshore assets. And that was a part of the proposal. And that's the bit that they've pulled back from. And that's very welcome. I don't believe that that in itself is sufficient to stem the tide of people who are considering moving out of the UK. So it's a step in the right direction, but it's certainly not far enough.
So can you just list the changes that the Treasury proposed this week?
They say that the remittance basis will, those choosing the remittance basis will not be required to make this disclosure of the offshore assets. That's very helpful. That was a great concern to a number of the wealthiest people. The point about offshore trusts, the proposals which I believe has really stirred up the problem in the last couple of weeks, is that when the draft legislation was released, it was absolutely clear from that that the Treasury were keen to clamp down on the use of offshore trusts. And in fact, in a pretty draconian way, what they've said in this letter is that there will be no retrospection. In other words, gains made before the cutoff on the 5th of April will be clean, as under the current rules. The third aspect that they mentioned, which is the payment of the £30,000 levy, as you know, the Chancellor announced that you could continue to use the remittance basis for income and gains, i.e. only pay tax on remittances, if you were prepared to pay a £30,000 levy. And I believe a lot of people were concerned that in order to pay the levy, you'd have to bring money in from overseas to do it. So am I effectively suffering double taxation? Well, that point has been clarified, and that is certainly welcome. And as a result of quite a lot of lobbying from the art world, they've made a statement that bringing in works of art to the UK for display will not be treated as a remittance. So useful clarification, but it doesn't go far enough because it still leaves in place the major changes to the tax treatment of offshore trusts, which I believe is the main outstanding point that non-domiciliaries will be unhappy about and may force them to leave the country.
So if you are a foreigner and you are living here, and what should you do before April 6th to prepare for this if you've been here for more than 7 years?
Well, even if you haven't been here for more than 7 years, don't assume that just because I've only been here for a couple of years, I don't need to do anything, because the offshore trust changes are going to come in on the 6th of April unless the government have a sudden change of heart. The message in planning terms is that you should look at all the assets of your trusts and seriously consider triggering any gains within those assets before the 5th of April. I mean, it may make sense in some cases to transfer all these assets out of trust. It may no longer make sense to hold assets in trust.
That was Ellen Kelleher talking to Mike Warburton of Grant Thornton. And for full details of the tax rules, look out for Ellen's article in FT Money on the 16th and 17th of February. Coming up, we have good news and bad news on high-rate savings accounts from overseas banks. Before that, though, exchange-traded commodities. These stock market-listed investments have long made it possible to invest in oil, metals and agricultural products and profit from their rising prices. But what if oil prices start to come down, gold loses its luster, and food price inflation abates? Well, now you can profit from falling commodity prices too. John, you've been looking at this. How's it done?
Well, I spoke to William Ryan from ETF Securities. They've just launched 66 of these new exchange-traded commodities, including both leveraged ones and shorting ones. So this is what he had to say.
There are going to be two types of exchange-traded commodity, or ETC. 33 long leveraged, which give you two times the exposure to the underlying commodity or index. And then there are going to be 33 short securities, which give you a one-for-one inverse relationship to the underlying index or commodity.
So the leveraged ones would be if you were kind of bullish on commodities, and the shorting ones would be if you thought there was a downturn, presumably.
Yes, very simply, if you want to apply leverage to a particular index or commodity, then you can do that two times leverage through the ETC. If you want to preserve capital, of course, with the two times leverage, it costs you half as much capital to get the same exposure as 100% of the long. Similarly, on the short side, if you have a bearish view on a particular commodity, you can implement that using the short securities.
And in bringing out short ETCs, is that to an extent reflecting a kind of concern that the commodity cycle might be coming to an end?
It's not a concern that the commodity cycle is coming to an end. What the short platform does is it provides investors with access to a different return dimension for commodities markets. Now, of course, the fundamentals, you know, we're still believers in the fundamental story for commodities, but some of those commodity groups will go up and some will go down. And what the short platform does is allow investors to take advantage of any particular commodities which they're bearish on.
And I believe that you can do things called pairs trades with the short ETCs.
That's right. I think probably the main application for the short ETCs, as far as ETF securities are concerned, is going to be for clients who are looking to hedge out particular portfolio exposures or to implement things like pairs trades. Now, currently in the market, there's not really an efficient way of going short on the commodities or the commodity indices. And this product gives you that. It also enables long-only investors who buy commodity companies to be able to hedge out some of the commodity risk in there. It also very simply means that investors can put on pairs trades if they are more favorable towards the commodity companies or more favorable towards the commodities themselves. So if you were very bullish on a particular sector, say a mining sector, and you thought that the mining sector would outperform the underlying metal, you could short the gold or the silver or platinum or whatever the particular metal for that relevant sector was and go long the equities. Vice versa, if you thought that the stocks were going to underperform, you could go long the actual metal and short the ETC or ETF basket of mining stocks.
Okay, and there are some phrases which commodity investors may have come across, backwardation and contango, referring to kind of the future price and the current price. Could you unpack that for us, please?
Yes, certainly. A backwardation contango refers to the shape of the futures curve in commodity markets. So when a market is in contango, the price of the futures contracts is higher in the future than it is today. So if you think about today being the spot price or the value of the generic one-month futures contract, if the market's in contango, futures contracts for delivery for future dates, the price is higher than it is today. Now, backwardation is the opposite of this. So prices in the future are lower than they are today. So therefore, if a market's in backwardation, every time you roll your futures position, you earn a little premium on the roll because for the same amount of exposure, it's costing you less and less and less. Whereas in contango, it's the opposite way around.
William Rhines of ETF Securities there. So, John, these shorting exchange-traded commodities, I mean, it's possible to make money if and when commodity prices fall. But it's always been possible to do that using spread bets, hasn't it?
That's right. You can use spread bets, futures, options, contracts for difference. There's a number of different ways. But one of the advantages of ETFs is that they're exchange traded. People buy them like shares through a stockbroker. You don't have to go to a specialist broker to use them. And you can't lose more than the amount of money you put into them. Whereas with a spread bet, if the market keeps rising and you're short of the market, you could make an almost unlimited loss unless you've set a stop loss in it or order in place.
So there is this sort of margin of safety there. Although, Steve, do you think the average private investor is in a position to take a view on commodities prices and try to trade short-term falls?
Well, quite, Matthew. I mean, it's only in recent years that people have started hearing and wanting to believe the commodities story. You know, this is part of the emerging market story, the China, you know, endless consumption of all these commodities. So now if private investors are being asked to take a view on when that commodity story is over, not just taking a view saying, I no longer want to participate in it, but actually saying, I'm going to bet on some of these things becoming a bubble. And I think it's fair to say that while there has been a broad commodities boom, there have been big differences within individual commodity prices. And there are often a lot of technical factors as well that drive individual commodity prices. You know, for example, not saying specifically, but gold, I think, might be very different from soybeans and pork bellies and all the rest of it. So, I mean, my question is, isn't this just one step removed for many private investors?
And John, I suppose one other factor is those commodities on which a private investor may be able to take a view, say the oil price or perhaps even gold, the spreads on spread bets, you know, between the price at which you can buy or sell a bet are really quite narrow. So the costs are low and competitive with exchange-traded commodities. But it's exchange-traded commodities only really come into their own in terms of cost in the more weird and wonderful things like corn or soybeans, as Steve was suggesting. So do you think they'll take off?
William Ryan explained to me that the areas that are most popular with investors at the moment are agricultural commodities and the precious metals, because they're seen as being less correlated and more defensive. And there is a worry that base metals could fall if global growth falls. But so far, the correlation is broken and markets are down, but the base metals have gone up. It is a more esoteric market, so you could just use a commodities fund to take general exposure. But if you do want to dabble, then why not?
And if you do want to double, how do you do it? Just through a stockbroker, just like you'd buy or sell a share?
Yeah, I mean, they're all listed on the London Stock Exchange. You can find fact sheets on the London Stock Exchange website, which is londonstockexchange.com, and off you go.
Well, sounds very easy. But if you'd like to know more details before you take the plunge, you can read an article all about these exchange-traded commodities in the Investors Chronicle, on sale from the 15th of February. And finally today, it's good news, bad news on savings accounts. Now, Steve, as the old saying goes, I thought the only reason that Mum went to Iceland was to buy fish fingers. But apparently, going to Iceland can deliver better interest rates on your money?
Well, what we're seeing at the moment, Matthew, despite now we've had two base rate reductions in recent months, and there will be one or two more, notwithstanding Mervyn King's comments about inflation worries, we're in an environment where interest rates are coming down. Despite that, there's a hell of a lot of competition for savings out there, credit squeeze, general competition. But one of the issues as well has been this kind of influx of foreign banks, and including many from Iceland, with names like Kaupthing and Icesave. So some of these are, many of these are in the best buy tables, typically internet banks and so on, but currently offering 6% plus when base rates, of course, have come down to 5.25. So that's the good news, that despite a falling base rate environment, you can still get some fantastic rates on savings, and even better on fixes, of course, which, of course, would protect you from further cuts in rates. The bad news generally is that most savings rates are coming down, and after last week's base rate cut, you are going to see most savings rates come down in the next few weeks, and we're probably going to see further cuts and so on. One question for savers as well is, do they want to entrust their savings to overseas banks? Perfectly reasonable question. Number one, they should be properly registered if they're advertising in august publications like the FT and so on. But as we saw last year with the run on Northern Rock, even regulated, supposedly big and supposedly stable banks can face runs and so on. Now, what would happen in a compensation situation? The government's increased the compensation safety net. So your first £35,000 is protected. So maybe one answer is only have £35,000 with any institution that's regulated in the UK. But there's a further tweak or quirk in these foreign banks. Many of them have a kind of almost dual registration, dual regulation system, whereby if they did go bust, then compensation, the UK compensation authorities would first turn to the domestic, in this case the Icelandic banking authorities, for the first lump of money. So the net effect could be that even though £35,000 is protected under the UK system, UK savers are protected to that degree, it could take longer to get your money back. And of course, furthermore, there's perhaps possibly a bigger risk. You know, plenty of readers out there will have more substantial sums than £35,000. So unless you're prepared to spread them around banks, your £100,000 in a bank going bust could be at risk. Now, and the big question, of course, is are Icelandic banks any more risky than other banks? Well, who knows is one answer in the credit squeeze. The market says they have additional risks, but do they have any greater risks than other banks?
So do you really want to have to get on a plane, fly to Reykjavik and stand on a freezing cold pavement for several days to get your money out? John, that's painting a very stark picture of what the risks might be. I mean, how realistic do you think these are? I mean, would you put your money in an Icelandic bank? I'd be tempted to.
Well, I don't really have any money. You'll have to pay me more. But, I mean, I think there's a degree of xenophobia about this. I mean, there might be an issue with dealing with people on helplines, potentially, if you have accent problems. But basically, as long as a company is registered, is regulated by the Financial Services Authority, then you're protected to 35,000. And there's an article in the current, in the forthcoming Investors Chronicle about all this. And if they're listed at moneyfacts.co.uk, which is probably the best site for savings in the UK, everything that's listed there is FSA regulated. So you should be on safe ground as long as you stick to this 35,000 limit.
Well, clearly, you pays in your money and takes your choice. And you've got two choices of where to get further information on this. There's an article in Investors Chronicle, which is on sale from the 15th of February, and Steve's article on savings and overseas banks is in FT Money on sale on the 16th and 17th of February. But that's all we've got time for in this week's FT Money show. Remember, you can email your views and your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Steve and John.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.